A good afternoon and welcome to a Rambling Virologist Dream on 3CR at 1 o'clock. We're living dreams and actioning ambition. On to the last week's show, we had a band in called the Bipolar Bears. Now, this whole series is about living dreams, actioning ambition, to give people an insight about what is expected in the world of entertainment and the creative industries. In this studio today, I have got two very important guests. I have got Neil Cole, a playwright and published author, and Samuel McDermott, a film director and producer. Welcome to the shows, guys.
Good to be here.
Good to be here, my good man.
Now, we're talking about creativity, and it's like the chicken and the egg question. What comes first, making a movie or writing a script?
Well, personally, I think it's writing a script. What do you think, Neil?
Well, you can't really make something without the script, but the ideas, I suppose, are what happens before all of that, really.
Right, and how does a person start by writing a script, Neil?
Well, I've only written one script, but I've written plays, but scripts for movies I've only done one. I think really you just got to get lots of ideas together. Don't write about anything you don't know about. And then you just sit down at your computer or with your pen and you start penning it out. I suppose that's the way to do it. But there is a lot of skill involved in writing. There's a lot of formulas to follow for writing movies as opposed to plays. So if you're writing movies, you're really writing pictures. You've got to work out all the different pitches and how you can present that. But the good thing about it is that with all the commercialisation and what capitalism done to us, they haven't taken away the capacity of people to be creative and to write if they want to. They don't need massive amounts of money. You can do it you can do it at a scout hall in Footscray if you want to. I've done that actually. So that's, I suppose, where it should all start, just people working out what they want to do, knowing what they want to do, and proceeding accordingly to get it written.
Now, Sam, from a film director's point of view, when somebody actually gives you a script, how do you go about putting a script into action?
Well, the first thing we do is read the script through completely, usually one or two times. We read the script through completely, usually one or two times, just to make sure that it's actually viable for a movie. Not every script you get can actually be turned into a movie, and some of them will require massive budgets you'll turn off. Then you look for each page and begin to break down what you're actually going to need. Each scene will tell you what's going to need, how many actors, how many cameras and all those things, which only give you an idea as you start looking at it. That's the first, next step. So once you've broken down into steps, you see, is it actually filmable and is it possible to be doing this movie within our budgets? Then, of course, you look at what budget you think you're going to need, and then it begins acquiring the money to make that budget, and then the fun goes on there.
Right, and as a writer, Neil, you mentioned that a person needs to actually know what they're actually talking about to write about. How does a person learn about becoming an gaining experience or becoming an expert to write about something?
I think the best thing to say about playwriting is it's not about... Everybody says, you know, the secret to rewriting is rewriting, the usual sort of views. But I think it's probably more about remember with playwriting, less so than in movies, but that's a different thing. It's just constantly a process of development. So you don't need to worry about the fact that, you know, it doesn't look too good the first time you do it. But usually what happens, of course, people think it's great the first time they do it, and in fact it's not very good at all. So it's about that. It's about getting it forward. I'm actually teaching a playwriting course next year from February 7th of February for 5 weeks, 6 weeks. 5 weeks about how to write a play, and the 6 weeks is how to get a play to production. But it's not cost. I'm doing it for nothing. I've got about 10 people who want to do it so far. I'm just going to do it at the Florey Institute. So it's a very good way of actually saying, you know, somebody said to me once, you don't drive a car after you've looked at the manual. You drive the car first, and then when things, you look at the manual. It's a bit like that. I think in a way you've got to go out there and really have a go and then stop and get advice on how to actually write a play. So it's a good to be able to write plays because you can do them. You don't. It's not like a film where you need money and you need all. You can sort of get things done with films. But I would say get there, just start to write it, and then go and have a look at structure and proper dialogue and so on.
Well, Neil, the first play, which I think that you won an award for this one, Alive at Williamstown Pier, the Griffith Award New Australian Playwright in 1999. Was that the first play you wrote?
It was, yeah. That was the Griffin Theatre Award for the best new writing for theatre in Australia. But, yeah, that was the first one I wrote, which, again, came back to the very principle of I wrote it out of frustration because I wrote a book, and the book was a really good book in my view, but, you know, it's too difficult. So I converted it into a play and La Mama put it on. Right. So it was just lucky. It was lucky in one sense, but also there was a lot of hard work that went into getting it. And then, of course, just to make people feel good about the process, that we put that play on three times in Melbourne, and then it won the award up in Sydney. And I did more and more development of that play until it finally went on in Sydney. So it was about 2 years of development, one way or another. So just shows you that it's not a static process. It's very, very theatrical. It's very got to put in a lot of theatre stuff. It's a process that grows and develops the more you're involved. There must be a finite point to when a play goes on, but there's a lot that goes on before that, and that's probably what people don't realise.
Now, Sam, is that Neil has mentioned that there's, when writing plays, for example, it might be a 2-year process and it's continually evolving. How long would that actually compare to, like, when a person goes to, let's say, make a music video or make a film, how long would it actually take to actually put that onto a format which people maybe could make it watchable?
Well, I'll give you an idea. We're just finishing post-production for one of our films now called The Green Woman, and I'll give you an idea. I started writing that, and it was 9 months after I finished writing it. Did we go through all the script editing, the script reviews and all those things? Then we began getting actors in to begin the training. So it was almost a year after the finishing of the script before we actually started doing any work. But it's a year of development, I must say. We go through the script editors to make sure everything fits right and feels right. Often, half the time you end up not doing what they're telling you. But just to make sure if things find out it's okay. And then we start the development with the actors. So seeing what the actors can act and how well the lines can work with them. A script is not static. A movie script is not static. Actors can have issues, and there can be ways that they can come up better. Some certain personalities bring up things better. So you can, once that, we're going to start evolving a new script called the acting script, or the production script is often called, and it'll help put all the new additions that we put into it. So it can be up to a year's worth of things before you even start filming. And then on the days, you may change small amounts and things. So it can go through up to, you know, go through right to there. And then post-production, you can change things yet again in the movie. For instance, we had a transition scene that we decided in post-production it would give a theme to it to make it feel a little something to add to the movie. So we start changing it up in the movie, even though that wasn't originally placed in the script to do that. But we can do that. So basically the script continues evolving pretty much to the point it's finished. And then as soon as that gets done, it then comes into a situation where it can be released for people. And usually those are either in the movies, online, or distributed that way.
Right. Now, I'm just going to use the analogy that if a person's writing, is that they can maybe sit down anywhere to make that a little spot where they have maybe an office, a keyboard, a pen and a paper for their location. Now, Sam, from a point of view, when you want to write a scene, how important is it to choose your locations?
Oh, very important. If you've got someone coming in every 10 seconds bothering you, you do not get writing done. You need to find yourself somewhere nice and quiet. I mean, I know there's the fond trend to Starbucks, but for myself, I have to be isolated away in a room by myself, writing away, so I have time to imagine things going on without being disturbed. I know quite a few writers that are the same. You really just need to find yourself something where you can be isolated. It can be just a little room in the corner. It can be a little study room. It can be your bedroom. Just somewhere where you can actually fit and feel, where you can do work and not be too distracted.
And one of the exciting projects I think you've been both being involved in is a series called Into the Limelight, Neil.
Yeah.
What was Into the Limelight about?
Well, the concept we started over 10 years ago was to engage people with mental illnesses in a theatrical process to see if that engagement would improve them. Because there's this great body of evidence that people with mental illnesses are a higher percentage of people who are creative have mental illnesses, particularly mood disorders. So I wanted to test it to see whether it worked or not, and we called it Into the Limelight, and we did the first ones we did in Footscray, St Albans, Mildura. We mostly did it with people with schizophrenia, and we found that people enjoyed it. They seemed to get a lot out of it. It was very, very entertaining. And what we also found was it's the process, so that I used to sit down with people once a week of a Thursday and go through what we thought should go into the play. We would write, and we wrote very good plays. And then we'd bring in a director, and they would organise it so that it could be to a performance, which it did. And the other important factor was not only of participation per se, like turning up, but they turned up and they were engaged in a process that I never had before, with actors and directors and producers and a whole series of activities. And, people, I think, enjoyed that, enjoyed it being involved in a lot. The one we've got going at the moment, Into the Limelight down at Paran Mission, we got funded by Martin Foley, from mental health money as well as Ministry for the Arts money, to try to do a similar thing. We've got 15 people with mental illness, most of them with schizophrenia, again trying to see whether by being engaged in that process, which means I've got directors and we've got somebody on set and we've got all the accoutrements that should go with a production, and to see whether they enjoy or gain something out of that. And to date, we think they are. It's not a panacea for their ills, but it's certainly something they seem to want to do. And we want to push it up to another level over the next 2 or 3 years.
Now, Sam, you've been directing a number of these skits as making them into a film. What has this process been like working with people with a disability?
It's actually been quite enjoyable, I must say. I found a lot of them were very keen to get involved in it. A lot of them had a great love of film, and a lot of them wanted to give it a try and have some fun. It was a great process working with them, I must say. Some of my favourite times as a director has been down in this program.
And if how does a person, if they're going to, let's say, working entertainment, Sam, around films, what is part of the process of learning how to audition? What can people expect? How do they go about it?
Okay, let's start from the beginning. Let's start from there and go from the bottom. How does one get auditions these days? In the old days, it was a long and costly proverb of having to get oneself an agent and hope that the agent found the right auditions for you. These days, thanks to the world of internet and indie film, that's a lot changed. Most of the time, to save a lot of money, directors and that are going straight out and just putting ads out for auditions, for anybody who wants to audition. For instance, you go on the internet, and you join several of the independent groups, Melbourne Film and all those things, and now place auditions out daily for what they're requesting, and just join all those groups, and you get more access to auditions than you generally would with an agent. From there, you just apply as requested. You read the requirements. For instance, you don't want to apply for one that says an 18 to 25-year-old female when you're a 50-year-old male. You want to make sure that you actually fit into the groups, or roughly around about in the groups, and you believe that you can do it. Once you're sure of that, just message the people and tell them that you're interested in doing the job. Now, auditions are quite fun to do, and they're quite not as hard as most people think. You give them a small bit of things to read. It's not so much your ability to remember the lines, it's your ability to capture the character. For instance, if you're given one that that the lines are going to be difficult to remember, focus on developing the character up in your mind. You can even add lines, ad-lib lines, even do a whole different line set. As long as you prove that you know the character, that's really what they want to see most of the time. You can be taught your lines over time, But catching the character is actually quite hard. So it's quite easy. Go in there, learn your character, be polite and be humble, which is probably, if you ask me, the most important part. Because as a director, we'll see quite a few people in a day. We can see anywhere up to 40 people a day for the same role. And if you already look like you're going to be a pain in the bum, we just move straight on to the next one. Because, as I said, there's another 39 people who apply for that day, generally that day, to see an audition. So that's the best, my best things to you. Ask questions, feel free questions before it. Say, I'd like to understand the character better. Any questions that you ask is always interesting. And if you do them in the right way, it only shows the people that you are more interested in it. But definitely these days, try getting the groups in. It's more likely the easiest way to get auditions. Once you have gotten some name up and you've gotten some auditions done, your name will get held back with quite a few production companies, and they'll just like keep you there on book as well. So they might invite you in later and or just straight off offer your job.
I see. Now, Neil, is it when a person's writing plays about character development, how does a person actually develop characters to make them either likable or people can relate to?
I've got an interesting story about that.
Sensational.
The first time I developed a character, it was based on a mate of mine. And he was so over the top and so bad, I thought, I can't do this without getting his approval. So I showed him the play, and he came back about 2 days later and he said, "Geez, that Mick guy, he's a whacker, isn't he?" It didn't occur to him that it was him. So I think it's very important if you want to make characters, don't worry about who you're doing them about, because most people won't know it's them anyway. Or worse still, you do a character innocently. This happened to me when I did this political play called The Campaign. It was about my friend Richard Wynne, and there was one woman in it. And I had so many women come up to me saying, "Was that so-and-so you based it on? Was that my friend?" Yeah, and then they'd go into some great commentary about, and I'd say, "No, I made it up." But, you know, they thought it was, obviously it was a good job of making it up. But the other thing is with making characters, what everybody makes the mistake is that they forget they have to have characters. And the characters have to be characters. They've got to be good. They've got to be people that you want to know. You've got to have whether they're good, bad, indifferent. No, there's no such thing as an indifferent. I'm exaggerating. There's no such thing as an indifferent character. You've got to try to create them. You've got to try to say, all right, here's this person. We'll call him Mick. And this is what he is. He drinks too much. He bets too much. He's a really good bloke, but he's his own worst enemy. You know the type of person. You put him in, and then you juxtapose him with somebody who's a straight lace, who doesn't drink, who wouldn't bet under any circumstances, and the two of them are there, but who's the happy one? You know, you can actually look and say, oh, yeah, well, you know, in a way, he's happier, the one who's the drinker and everything. Who knows? But you have to be able to devise characters, and they have to be able to engage the whole play to make it drive along. And what happens is people just develop either stereotypical characters or extremely boring ones, or they don't even think about how important it is. So the one way to do, the important thing to do is if you're going to write about a character, all your characters, you should know everything about them, when they were born, what they look like, what they do, You should know these characters so well, so when you sit down to write, the dialogue should just present itself. I'm exaggerating because it doesn't quite work like that, but if you don't have them there and real, and most people, it's very, because I'm at work at the Howard Florey or the Florey Institute, and I'm a consumer consultant, that is, I deal with people with mental illness. I get a lot of people who give me their plays, both mental illness and not, and the first thing you notice, not the first thing, but quite often, that they've got 17 characters in it, which is an excuse, I think, for not writing your dialogue properly. I suggested to one bloke once that he should get it down to 4, and he got very angry with me. So I just said, "Ah, stuff you, if you don't like it, too bad." And then he went and he changed it. He rang me, so I changed it down to 5, and it was a very good play. And went really well, but was stuffed up by producers, which is another story. But the character issue is so important in playwriting. Unless you do it, unless you create them, and it doesn't hurt. Like what I've done sometimes, if I've based it on a man, in order to so it doesn't the same, I've changed it to a woman. So you've got the woman character with the same desires and needs, etc., as the bloke, but a woman, you know.
Right, is it? On A Rambling Paralysis Stream, we are talking with Neil Cole, playwright, Sammy McDermott, film director and producer, and we're going to take a station announcement right now, and we'll be back in about 60 seconds.
When that sun shines, we'll be there with you. Get your summer love with 3CR this summer. Oh, yeah.
Summer love is like no other love.
Woo! Yeah!
Summer love is like no other love.
Know what I mean.
Summer love.
Okay, we're back live on the air. This is A Rambling Paralysis Stream that is replacing Living Free over the summer programming break. Summer Living Free will be back on the 19th of January 2017. Now, Neil Cole has just explained to us a little bit about character development. And prior to that, Samuel McDermott was talking about when a person is doing auditions, it's more important to actually know the character when you're actually auditioning. But from a director's point of view, how does character development work when you're actually trying to shoot a film, for example, Sam?
Well, I'll take this from two sides. I'll do the movie writers and I'll take it from the actor side. The movie writer, like additions to Neil, does the same thing Neil does and creates 3 to 4 pages on just stuff about them when they were born, what they're like, stories about them, how we even create stories about their first date, even though it might not come up. But that affects, all these things affect their behaviour, who their first crush was, how their first crush ended. All those sort of things affect everybody's behaviour. So we'll go ahead and take care, put those into a list. And then when it comes time to creating the character, when we've got the actor, we work with the actor to create a thing called a mood board, which is a title, and I have all the images and things that they've put around it to help them associate with the board. For instance, they might say, I'm doing Princess Leia, so they put all the images around there they think associates with Princess Leia, Star Wars thing, independence, rebellion, that kind of stuff. And they use all those things to try and help focus them and the director into making sure the character's right. They'll also use a couple of keynotes occasionally on set. The director, if they want the character to hit something specifically. For instance, if they want the actor to make sure they always stumble a bit, they'll keep a key on set. If they want them to do things, a little note, just a little development. Little things like stumbling on set are actually really great ways of making a character seem good. Lowering their shoulders and things for the whole movie could be another way of making a character bring out depth. Just little tiny things add to the character. That's what we do in a movie. Instead of saying one big huge thing like this guy's a this or this girl's this, we add little tiny little things to allow the character development to go up and down, swing between what characters you're supposed to like more and things, and all that. It is a little easier a film to be able to do that.
Right, well, let's take it. How many films are there audio descriptions, Sam, for people that are visually impaired?
There are. I don't know how many films there are exactly. I'm sorry, I don't have that number.
Is it generically speaking? I mean, how difficult is to put audio description in?
Audio descriptioning could be done, but it would guarantee that just really they were the ones watching the movie because it became quite loud and over speaking. This is what happened. It could be done. There's no reason I can think of. I mean, look how successful the books were for the reading books. Although it might turn out to be a case of reading the script and doing a script play would might be better for them over the audio because not seeing the special effects anyway or any of the cutscenes that are making effort. So we might have to change that a little bit. Fill in a few details, but there's no reason we couldn't do a visual description for the visually impaired.
Right. Now when you're... I'm enjoying this little bit of a conversation about sometimes you write the lines and you think that it may work better if a female says the lines in a male does, they act out in a particular way, or a male might act in a female perspective. How difficult is it actually to conceptualise something like that?
I don't know. I don't think it makes much difference for me, but I've done a lot of female characters, and I think probably you're not really concerned about their gender as much as you are as with the dialogue and the conflict and the action and the drama that they're having with in the play. Well, the last play I did was all women. It was 1916, and we had I had Vida Goldstein and Adela Pankhurst, and I had lots of material to work with, so not that much, but I read all about them. So what I was really putting out was their ideologies, their beliefs, their foibles up to a point. And then there was another woman character in it, and then there was some others. But it was, I think it might, you know, might be a bit hard to sometimes write putting the woman in, but I don't think it's about the play and the construct of the play and the way it flows rather than the gender per se. I may have it wrong, but I haven't had any women say to me that the characters that I'm doing don't represent women. But I'd be very conscious of all that. But there's a lot of, you know, you can have female directors, I suppose, and they help bring or draw that out for you too. But look, comes back to the very simple proposition. As long as the characters are characters and they have something, they want something, they're in conflict, it's very simplistic. But if they're doing that, then all the other things will usually fall in place. That's what I find anyway. And I also think that the directors become very, very important in developing character and developing the play along.
Now, at the most recent Into the Limelight series of workshops, there were a series of comedy skits that you wrote.
Mm-hmm.
Now, how long did it take to actually write the series of skits?
Well, there's 15, but not all of them being presented. I don't know. Probably took me 2 or 3 months, but very, you know, I'd just go back to it every now and again, or an idea would present itself, so I'd go back to the ball, you know, working on it. So one of them, I was walking up the street and bumped into Isabella Fells, and we were having a bit of a laugh about something or other, and I thought, oh, gee, this would make a good script. And so we did it, and it was the Shopaholic one. So you can't force it when you're writing comedy, I think. When you're writing comedy things, you've got to just let it come to you, right? It's not just about having a lot of jokes. It's about having a, you know. So one time I was sitting around a mate of mine who I was at uni with, a QC now, an SC, and there was another one who was also an SC, and somebody else. And you've only got to be with barristers for 5 minutes and they start telling pathetic jokes about their bills and their costs, you know, really. So I and my mate Norman, I said to him, we should write about this. So we did. We ended up writing. I wrote it and he looked at it. It's called Chester CAD QC. And so you're developing all the time from what you hear and where you're with, right? But it's not easy to write. I find it easy to write comedy scripts. I love it. And you've got to get yourself into a comic milieu. So you've got to watch comedy things on. Well, you don't have to, but I do. You just get yourself up to speed with comedy, with things that are funny, really good things, and then try to think, you know, can I write all these? So that's why I've written 15 of them. They're all pretty funny. And I've got to write more, which we'll do. But they're a very important part of the creative process, having comedy sketches, because people can laugh. And particularly when you've got people who've got schizophrenia, whose laughs are few and far between, you introduce this thing of a comedy sketch, and suddenly they're doing something that's quite specific and it's focused. The other thing that it does, and it's probably something not only for people with mental illness but people who don't have it, with comedy sketches, is to take them away from their own self-centeredness. So there's a problem, you know, because you've got schizophrenia, you, like I've got bipolar and I'm a bit the same, you can't shut up about it sometimes. You want to tell everybody you've got it. And so if we take it out of the realms of that sort of drama and put it into a comedy format, then we're not going to have them diverting from that and they'll concentrate on that. That's assuming it is comedy and we can do it. So that's what I did, the sketches. And the sketches are very, very important. But and how to write comedy sketches is the other thing that people don't realise. It's quite difficult.
Now, Sam, what, from a practical point of view, about bringing a script and characters to actually life there, as the series of Limelight unfolded, did people like to know a little bit about the makeup, about the positioning of cameras and lighting?
Oh, yes. It was very important that we taught them that. We taught them all about positioning cameras, lighting. We taught them rules such as the 180 rule where cameras can go and things. We taught them makeup. We taught them clothing rules, even set design. So they could all really get an idea of what's going on. It's really quite, how should I say this, important that they get a grasp of all those things. I mean, and a good example is this, is if you don't know what you're doing, you stand on the set, the lighting can throw you off and you need to work out where you need to be on lighting and that. And it's really quite difficult. I'm going to be honest. Well, a lot of people have a hard time with it. So we had to sit down and make sure that all the participants could learn all that, could know what to do, and would have a fun time doing it. And I must say, they were very quick at learning it. I was very impressed.
Yep, and now, how hot does it get under the light, Sam?
Oh, it can get very hot. We were shooting once on a 43-degree day inside a sealed house. We couldn't have air conditioning on, one, because it was a humid one, and two, because it was the made noise. So we had a temperature in there, and we were operating at about 56 degrees underneath lights. We also had a painted woman, which made it really hard because she's sweating. So the moment we'd have to say cut, we'd have running a makeup artist to come in to patch up the sweat, dive of the sweat, patch it up, and other people come in to wipe off the walls in case she touched it and the paint would come up. It is difficult under the heat and takes a bit of patience, but for the right actor, the right participant, it's fun and it's a challenge.
Now, what about from a makeup point of view, Sam? Why is it important for a person to be able to, one, have makeup applied to them when they're actually on camera, but knowing a little bit about how to apply it to other people?
Well, it's good to have an idea in general what the makeup is doing, because sometimes you'll find on some sets you're going to have to do it yourself. But mainly the reason is because it teaches you all about how the makeup is and how to play with the makeup. For instance, how we can make you look tired and how to play with that. How to make your lips look like you've been thirsty and how to play with it. It's good to learn this so that everybody learns exactly what happened to them, how we can easily it is, and how they can use that little bit, making them a little paler, putting black rings around their eyes, and how they can learn to play with that. It's really good for people to learn how to play with their makeup. And once the makeup's on, it's pretty much like a new mask and a new person, so you can play all you want.
Well, is it, Neil, what about from a writing point of view? Is it, it's a technique called show but don't tell the reader. Would you like to elaborate a little bit on that?
Oh, that's crucial. Everybody tells, nobody shows. It's a given. So what you usually see, you go to see these plays, wherever you might go and see them, and they're telling us. So they're not actually got characters who are having proper discussion and dialogue. So in the case of our ones, the 15, they're all show, not tell. It's all about showing it. You know, they're different. I don't want to, you know, give away the punchlines or anything, but that is the big part. And all people need to do is start to remember that any line that's longer than one sentence has to be reviewed. And any monologue that goes for 24 pages is not practical. And if it goes for one page, it should be totally dismissed. And if it's there at all, it should be thrown out. So people don't have to learn that it is show, not tell, and that's the hardest part to do.
Yeah, well, as I can actually think of an example of this, for something I wrote a couple of years ago for a music video, Attitude Princess. When I wrote the script for it, I said the lady, her bedroom door said invitation only. It was this little flat out, sort of like, not she had attitude, it was just the invitation only said was the thing to the reader to actually get the person to play the part, which they did. And as a person that's creative, Sam, how do you actually going about in filming, is it about more showing the person or trying to actually tell the story?
Well, trying to show the person's nature and tell the story as it goes. I mean, show, don't tell is an important rule because, one, it can become deus ex machina, explaining how everything works and putting a magical touch into it, and it can become quite boring having everything explained to you like a child, too. A good example of having show, not tell, for example, would be an end of the movie, Donnie Darko, when they're summing up the things. They're just playing music and showing each scene. They're not actually mentioning what's going on. They're not explaining to you what each scene means. They're just saying, here's this scene, here's this scene, here's this scene in concurrence. You need to figure it out. Show, not tell can be a great way of keeping a story interesting because it can allow the watchers to have a little bit, a bit of a disagreement about what they're seeing. Did this mean this? Did this mean this? And that opens up the good debate, which I personally think. Plus, it keeps the story interesting. Like I said, if you show everything, it takes away all the joys and it ruins any twists or Easter eggs.
Right. Now, Neil, what about from a point of view, if a person's a writer, how does a person get their work out into the community for people to read it?
Well, it's not all that hard, really. It's hard to get on at Melbourne Theatre Company or something if that takes you fancy, but I think it's probably just learning by having a reading of your piece with two or three people or others there, preferably somebody other than your mother and your father and your best friend, somebody that looks at it and says, oh, this is no good. And you have a reading of a play, and from the reading, then you rewrite and you go and see whether you can get on at La Mama, which is the best place to get on if you can, because it's such a great, opportunity. It's a good place. But, there's other places, Mechanics Institute, you can do it yourself or you can try to get others. It does. It's not easy, but it's not impossible to do it that way, And you want to be protected, I think. You want to know what you're doing and get it probably set in place before you go off and try to get it done. There's one thing that everybody has an aversion to in Australia, and in Victoria particularly, they've got an aversion to Australian playwrights. So if your name is Shakespeare, you'll get on. If it's Harold Pinter, anything, that'll get on. Or if it's some new modern hotshot from London, you'll get on. But if it's anybody in Australia, forget it. You haven't got a chance. So it's going to have to be some sort of marginalised approach to it.
Well, Sam, how does this actually work in the world of filmmaking? Does a person need to have a little catch cry or a little moniker to make them stand out when they're doing an audition?
No, not necessarily, though it does help sometimes. To stand out in audition, just really got to make sure you catch the character real, like I said. I've had people in my auditions who have not got a single word right in the line, but they were so good playing the character. I brought them back and for the second audition because they were just so good the character had to see them again to see if they could catch it and prove it. There are no great monikers, but you can find someone that's yourself as well. I know actors who overly dramatise things. For the right character, that's perfect. If you're playing yourself orientated characters, a little whining, caught up in themselves and lost, over-dramatising is great. So you want to show them that you can over-dramatise and do all that stuff. It is important, but it's more what you'll catch, what your talent can be to the specific script. I mean, you don't want to be overly comedic when it doesn't require comedic.
Right, now I think you've had a professional actor, Don Adams, to do some coaching with the Into the Limelight?
It's Don Bridges.
Oh, Don Bridges. Okay, well, Don Bridges, why is it important to actually have an actual acting coach to guide people through the process?
Well, a more experienced actor does help people find their character and things. I'll be honest, it does help that. It also helps everybody find a medium point. I mean, actors have different ideas, different egos and different views. So this can sometimes mean meshing them together can cause quite a few fights. I mean, I just know a lot of film people who've had a fight between the two main stars because they have two different views of where the movie should go. The acting coach actually is quite helpful coming in to make everybody see the right idea, see where everyone's going, and help them bring them together. In fact, I plan on using an acting coach in my next movie myself because the complexity of how the characters were interlinked to each other needs to be done like that.
Right. Now, Neil, what about how does a person go to collaborate when they're writing with others?
Oh, I don't. If you know somebody else who wants to be involved, you do it together, I suppose. That's all it is. And, you know, have your usual debates about what's being written and how. You can sometimes get a good synergy going, I suppose. But somebody's got to take the lead, inevitably, in what they're doing. But that's what you need to do with that sort of thing. I don't know whether people should collaborate when they're writing their first play. I think they're better off just getting it down and writing it and enjoying it.
Right, well, is it on the Rambling Parology stream? This is Rafael Collab. We are talking with Samuel McDermott, film director and producer, and Neil Cole, and we're going over for another station announcement.
Oh, no. Freeze, fellas, you're under arrest.
What do I do?
Call a lawyer.
Hello, Fitzroy Legal Service.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, well, if you are arrested, you should make a no-comment interview.
A no-comment interview?
Yeah.
Well, how do I do that?
You say...
No comment!
To everything?
Yes, except your name and address. Every other question you should answer with no comment.
So if he asks me what colour my shoes are, I say no comment?
Yes, you say...
No comment!
To everything?
Yes, say...
No comment!
If you are arrested, exercise your right to contact a lawyer and say no comment. Fitzroy Legal Service proudly supporting 3CR.
You're listening to 3CR Radio.
Okay, we're back on a Rambling Virologist stream talking with Samuel McDermott, filmmaker and producer, Neil Cole, playwright and author. A Rambling Virologist stream is over the summer programming. Living Free will be back on the 19th of January 2017. Now, Sam, Neil was saying about when a person is writing their first play, they're better off actually just doing it mainly as a solo project. As a filmmaker, if a person actually wants to make their first film, how do they go about collaborating, or are they just happy to actually do it themselves?
Well, I myself find collaborating as a writing a difficult experience because the egos get a bit something. So I generally write by myself, to be honest. And to that, writing it, you're doing your first play, or your first movie in this case, is stick to the certain rules. Avoid the script rules. To be honest, I'm not a man who thinks the rules and scripting work that great. Many movies are great when they break the rules. Some movies are boring when they have excessively rich the rules. So my first thing is just write a synopsis of the movie. A 2-page long length, just point fact where you think the movie's going to go, what's going to happen. Because never start writing a script until you know what the ending's going to be. I know that seems a bit odd, but you waffle and wave and you go everywhere. So you know what the ending is going to be. You know what the twist is or whatever. You've got that figured out, you know what the intro is, and then you start writing. And then you should look at your synopsis. Your synopsis should have every point in between it, every step, a major point development. And then there's half written for you. So in between, you just really got to write the dialogue in between the spots. Synopsis should have no dialogue unless it's a really great line that you want in there. So you just put that in there. So in my case, I have to admit, though, I have gone overboard. I've done 2-page synopsis, and I've come back and then gone back and done a 60-page synopsis, and then just put the dialogue into it pretty much and turns into a script. That's a great way if you know what you're doing, but that's really good if you're becoming the writer and the director, because you're writing everything to how you plan to view it, how you plan to shoot it. So you can really bring it out. But for a general writer, just write as how you know it, write the dialogues, and write the basic idea of what you want everybody to do. Don't focus on directions of the character, as most actors do not pay attention to them anyway, and there's quite a few groups that don't allow you to, I don't want groups with too much direction in them anyway. So just focus on finding the story you want to tell. Don't just don't try to sit down and typewrite and make a story. Find the story that it is that's important to you. Say a story that you know, something you know, and talk about something you know, and then find a summary in there, a story or a message you want to tell the world. And then from there, you develop it all up.
Yeah, I mean, it's an interesting point about collaboration. A few years ago when I was doing a lot of music, the guitarist and myself had these pretty full-on arguments. And apparently it was a bit like cold chisel when they started off. You could hear about 200 blocks away. But it was a lot of fun with just kiss makeup and try to get what we thought was best for the audience in the meantime. And that brings rise to that great little saying which I heard years ago, and I'd like an individual opinion from both yourself, Neil, and from you too, Sam, a little bit of a comment. Anger is the fuel that starts creativity. Neil?
Oh, it's one aspect, anger. think we probably find theatre develops better where there's not wealth, where it's it arises out of circumstances of people's, you know, of poverty, and of it's more likely to evolve from that than a place like Australia where we can all go off to the beach and get sunny and go to the cricket and do all that sort of stuff, as opposed to a place like England. Like, you notice it's palpable, the difference. So I think probably it's about people having something to say rather than anger as part of that, having something to say. So it's why we see, quite rightly, so much stuff about, so many plays about women and feminism, and so many plays about Indigenous people, and they've all got something to say and want to express it. So, it probably does come from that, but it doesn't. It's not exclusive to that, but it's a very big part of theatre. It's like when you're dealing with conservatives and they attack the ABC or they take away $100 million from the arts, and when you think, well, basically you're saying you don't like anybody that's confronting the status quo. And the problem for people in theatre is, and in movies, but theatre is what I know, we're constantly confronting the status quo. We're actually trying to say something because that's what we believe or that's what we feel. So I probably, rather than looking at it as anger, we look at it's people have something really solid to say. So like that course I'm doing on playwriting, which is free, starting in February the 7th, the idea is that people can come who have got something that they want to say but don't have the mechanisms to say it, like writing how to write a play. Like if they write a film script, the odds are it won't get on, right? With a play, even though there's this antipathy towards Australian plays in the mainstream, though you wouldn't call Red Stitch mainstream, if you've got all these places which don't want to have Australian play, it's going to be hard, but it's not impossible. And if your plays develop properly in it, then you just never know where you might be able to put it on and what you might be able to do. So I think it's probably anger is part of it, but not the whole of it. I think the more complex issue is what where people have something to say. Like I've written 25 plays, and I've always done 25 or 26, I can't remember now, but I've always done what I wanted to do, whether it was to write a comedy, even when writing comedies. Like I wrote a comedy about Richard Wynne, the now planning minister, and what I was really saying was, you know, what are we really, why do we debate? What are we doing? It's really just internal stuff going on. It's got very little to do with what you actually do, and that predominates within our society. So I think it's more about people having something to say rather than anger per se.
Now, Sam, what are your thoughts about anger and the creativity process? Is it actually the fuel that drives the whole process?
There's a famous line from a movie that I think works well here, and it's quite well. It's by Captain Kirk, who goes, "I need my pain. It makes me who I am. I need my pain. It makes me who I am." I do think in the writing process, we do require a certain amount of pain to make good stories. All the best stories, really, in the movies and that have been written from angry or hurt people. Having said that, it should not be the only focus of the story. There should be a message a message in all that pain or that anger. But pain and anger does help make better movies. Maybe not necessarily just pain. Anger can be rejection, can be isolation. It can come from a lot of pain from different areas. But that pain helps you write better stories, I found. Helps you write better characters, brings them more depth. Because the truth is, everybody somewhere is hurting something. We all fake our happiness to a degree most of the day, but most of us have anger or hurt somewhere deep down, resentment or something. So it makes it quite easy to make a character that's more believable and help better talent if you show pain. Even in the happiness, you can swap it around. You can say, here's the person being pain who finds happiness and finds a way to shed the pain. But I think ultimately at the beginning, the pain and the anger helps create and help shape what you want to say. Because, for instance, as Neil was saying, helps might make your statement be better. If you're doing, say, a feminist one, it's your anger about the mistreatment of women, which helps you make a better play. for instance. So it does have its place. It can't be everything, but I do think it is rather important.
Now, is that, Neil, is it, you've mentioned you've got a series of workshops that are coming up at the Howard Florey
Institute.
At the Florey Institute. Can you put over what the details are?
Oh, yeah. It's on at the Kenneth Meyer Building, which is the directly opposite, 35 Royal Parade, directly opposite the hospital. And I'm going to do them at 6 o'clock on each of the Tuesdays and in March on the Tuesdays. Do five, and then the sixth one will be how to get a production up, which will be very interesting because I can only relate my experience. But the other things are the general, the start of it, the five seminars will be about how to, the first one is just a general introduction, what is a play and how do we distinguish it from being something else, and little things about how we should write plays and what we should be doing and avoiding. And then the rest of it is a structure, character, dialogue, and they're all in the separate seminars. So that's what it is, and it goes for 5 weeks and then the sixth one.
And how long are each of the seminars?
Seminars are an hour and a half. We're going to have an actor who'll come in, and she will be, her and I will be performing together, you know, the different aspects of different plays and what not to do and what is good and so on, so that it's an interactive process rather than just, you know, talking to. We want to see what it is to do, you know, what it is that an actor has to be able to do. You can't just write from an assumption that you're right and you can write. Like, I've had people write page-long, 2 pages of monologues. Like, they're just not doable. So that's what it is. It's a very practical course, I hope. I've never done it before. It doesn't cost anything. Only $10 for the coffee. And so we're getting a contribution towards the coffee.
Is that $10 for the whole series of workshops?
No, each workshop, they can kick in $10 for the coffee and for the actor. That's all. So that's what it is.
And
so it doesn't cost anything other than the $10, and you're welcome to come along. And if you can't afford the $10, well, we'll let you in anyway.
And how many people are you looking for each workshop? Are there a limit of the numbers?
No. I've got 10 so far. I'm quite happy to have many more. Doesn't worry me.
But you've got 10 people. And how about you, Sam? Have you got any workshops or things like that coming up for people?
Actually, yes, we do. Our group is beginning to arrange new films workshops. For anyone interested in making film, we have a lighting course coming up shortly for all the directors, producers, and people who aren't gaffers. Just something to give everybody an idea of how to set up lighting. You won't be technically a gaffer, but you'll learn a lot about it. We've got some things for good actors out there, how to do some basic scenes, and we're going to be doing a day with learning how to do basic rehearsals and do auditions, as well as a day at the same time you get your photo taken, and we'll be setting you up to do your showreel. That one, unfortunately, will be a little more costly because it will make us actually having to get your professional done photos and showreels done up, but it will be something for a lot of people to come along and have some fun, learn some things, and get ready to start their career.
Yep, and just very, very quickly, is it a little bit too premature to actually announce details of that, Sam?
No, we should be going into that in February. Our announcements will be shortly about that on our site. If anyone looks to look up Senshut Film, which is SehnSucht Film on the Facebook, we're there, and we'll have our announcements very shortly about all that. We have got a lot of exciting new programs coming for 2017 for the crowd, and a lot of new training on ideas for everybody.
Well, this is a Rambling Barologist Dream. We've been talking with Neil Cole, a playwright and author, and Samuel McDermott, film producer and film director, about living dreams and actioning ambition. I'd like to say thank you very much for both Neil and Sam coming into the studio. Now, very quickly, Neil, if a person wants to get contact details, are you happy to give them out about any of your workshops?
Oh, yeah, sure. Did they ring here? I'm on 0438 129 711, or they can do my email. But they can ring here if there's any interest, you know, and preferred on.
All right. And, Sam, have you got a website for people to get in contact with you?
Sure. The best way to come onto our Facebook page at this moment is our webpage is getting redesigned. As for our new official launch in in about 20 days. So the best place to come to is Censured Film, is S-E-H-N-S-U-C-H-T Film. I know it's a bit funny. Or they can contact you at the station and we'll pass, and they can pass the details on to us. And we'll have lots of interesting things. Any potential actors, models, or anything else, feel free to contact us. And we're always looking for interested new crew.
Well, thank you very much. We've been talking with Neil Cole, Samuel McDermott. Thank you very much, guys, for coming to the studio and sharing your time. We're going out with the song The Hero Versus the Villain. And I guess that's a bit like writing and making films too, I guess. It's by a band called Calling Utopia. Next week on the Ramming Biologist stream, we've got Kathy Horsley from Port Phillip Council coming in. She's the Community Cultural Engagement Officer, along with Carla Mittinger, a participant and part ensemble member, along with Justine Sless, professional comedian of 10 years' experience, talking about drama and comedy as well. Thank you very much. Next up, we have got Kids with Attitude. Thank you very much for listening. Keep listening to 3CR.